Virginia Ramey Mollenkott comes from a background that was so fundamentalist that by the time she got to Bob Jones University, Bob Jones, that place seemed like the most liberal Christian place I had ever been. She says, it's all relative, darling. But during the 1960s, she began to read the Bible in a contextual way. And as a result, she was radicalized by the Bible. Whoa. She reports that it is always refreshing to be at a conference where she is regarded as somewhat conservative. Rather than as the wild, radical heretic the religious right considers her to be. Please help me welcome Virginia Ramey Mollenkott.
Was somewhat dismayed when I found that the organizers of this conference had assigned me to this session on church. Church, the worshiping community part was fine, but church. I have been struggling with what church does and does not, should and should not mean for my entire life. And perhaps that's exactly why I was given this assignment. My struggle with the church began in early childhood when I was forced to sit silently through more than 4 hours of Plymouth Brethren services on Sunday and another marathon on Tuesday night. But the struggle exploded into a whole lot more than boredom.
We're a little conservative on the microphone.
Sure. Let's get it
right.
Will
you please tell us when you can hear her clearly?
Okay, can you hear in the back? Okay. The struggle exploded into a whole lot more than boredom when I was 12 and my mother searched through all my belongings and found in them love letters to me from a girl who was also a member of our Plymouth Brethren Assembly. My lover was older than I, and she told me that what we were doing was called homosexuality. My mother told our secret to everybody at church before she sent me away in disgrace to a Southern Presbyterian high school where students as well as faculty had been informed about my abnormality. From then on, my relation to church was that of an outsider trying desperately to fit in. I was taught at that high school and at home that whenever a woman speaks or leads in church, the result is always heresy, along with all the rest of the misogynistic liturgy of the far right. So eager was I to fit in that it was not until the 1960s, when I was in my 30s, that I began to pull away from fundamentalist Christianity. I joined the Episcopal Church at that time, because it was the only one that I knew about that offered communion every Sunday, something which I had come to want from my experience in the Plymouth Brethren Assemblies. And as a result of the books I had begun to write to liberate myself, I began to do a lot of speaking, mostly to liberal audiences. At first, the more liberal church gatherings seemed like heaven to me. But then I began to discern a more subtle but insistent sexism and heterosexism and judgmentalism not far below the smiling surface. Now these conference organizers asked me to describe how I would imagine a community in which I would feel good about worshiping. In brief, my experience as an outsider has taught me to envision a depatriarchalized, post-colonizing, and genuinely inclusive, mutually empowering community of women and men. Whether or not Christian institutions can ever actually be transformed into those communities is something I will address in my conclusion. But first, I'd like to talk about these three major components of my reimagining. I accept Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza's definition of patriarchy, quote, a societal system of domination and exploitation that is structured by heterosexism, racism, nationalism, and classism, end quote. Therefore, the worship community I would envision would have to be sincerely determined to uproot in itself any vestiges of assuming that some people are entitled to more than others because of gender differences, sexual orientation, race, nationality, socioeconomic class, or any other reason human egos can drum up. To fuel that struggle against internal and external patriarchal oppression, the community would develop a feminist or womanist or holistic theology. This theology would take seriously the interrelationships among Christian thought and action and the context in which these thoughts and actions take place. Therefore, the worship model would look more like Latin American-based communities than like high-steepled churches, would look more like feminist or womanist 12-step meetings than star-studded lecture series. Ritual and preaching would have their places, but they would be built upon the experiences of the people and would rise up from those experiences. This church would worship God herself, with the gynocentric pronouns balancing off the androcentric term God. Just oppose it to goddess, and you understand very quickly the word is in and of itself androcentric. Or, of course, we might find some other inclusive set of terms. But we would avoid the androcentric language and the dominant submission theology that legitimates patriarchy with all of its violence. As an incest survivor, I can no longer worship in a theological context that depicts God as an abusive parent and Jesus as the obedient, trusting child. Too many Christian children have been told that if they want to be like Jesus, they must accept the abuse of their parents and proclaim their parents good. Too many parents have been told that to be good Christian parents, they must break the will of their children in order to save the world as God did by sacrificing his only son. This violent theology encourages the violence of our streets and our nations. In the reimagined church, the will of children as well as adults would be respected as a holy thing. Every effort would be made to join worship with political activism and to join scholarship and theology with daily life experience. Sin would be described as wrong relationship, as a collective system of coercion that is leading humankind towards self-destruction. Salvation would mean turning away from the constricted attitudes of the world's fear-driven consensus. Fear and guilt-driven consensus. Instead, we would seek together to enter into our Christ nature by realizing that just like Jesus, every blessed one of us remains at our core or essence exactly as we were created, the express image of God's person. To release and empower that essence would be the goal of worship. I often envision this worship community as an interreligious community. And I know that the term Christ has proved to be acceptable to people from many other religious traditions, as long as we also respect such terms as the Buddha nature, or simply the new nature. The community I envision would be empowered by the realization that, as Paul said in Romans 8, nothing in all the universe, including ourselves and including the patriarchy, nothing has ever been able to separate us from the love of God. Patriarchal ideologies may have stolen from us the joy of our status as the daughters and sons of God herself, but we can be transformed moment by the renewing of our minds. The community I envision would help each other work out the implications of that mental transformation in terms of everyday experience and global outreach. Specific attention would be paid to the kinds of work done by community members, and power would be understood in terms of mutual empowerment for the myriad tasks and relationships of life. In that sense, the last would become first, because those of us who work in powerful and gratifying situations would receive much less attention from the community than those who are doing poorly paid, low prestige, repetitious, and discouraging labor. Because we would recognize that nothing human beings have done or ever could do have ever separated us from the loving support of our divine source, this worshiping community would rejoice in the fact that everything that lives is holy, and therefore naturally would have strong ecological concerns. This community would no doubt be labeled monistic. And it would be monistic in the sense of worshiping God as above all and through all and in us all. The radical source of that quotation is Ephesians 4:6. But this monistic community would also be pluralistic, in the sense of being a heterogeneous, polyglot arena of competing, mutually moderating discourse. The one divine presence would be recognized in everybody by everybody, and a great deal of discussion would no doubt center on working out the supposed conflicts between identity and difference, spiritual oneness and apparent bodily separation, respect of self and respect for others and of the community as a whole. I hope that this community would understand the distinction between dualism and duality, something that seems to be lost on a great many Christians. Trapped as we sometimes are by androcentric categories, even some feminist theologians assume that either God must be the all-controlling other before whom the redeemed will grovel happily for all eternity, or a matrix totally undifferentiated from her creatures so that there's really no point praying And when we die, we lose all individual characteristics and get absorbed back into this undifferentiated matrix. But the monism I'm talking about assumes that God is so all-inclusive that she is involved in every cell of those who are thoughts in her mind and embodiments of her image. There is duality between the source and her manifestations, but there's no gap, no separation, no dualism. Dualism is dichotomy, but in duality, difference is supplementary, like the difference between husband and wife, friend and friend, partner and partner. We can't know the wholeness of intimate relating with another person until we are keenly aware of the duality of I and thou. And we can't know the wholeness of intimate relating with our divine source until we recognize the duality of creator and creature. Like Jesus, we and the source are one. Yet we are not identical with our source in the sense of losing all of our identifying characteristics. Our basic union with God and with each other in duality, but not dualism, could provide us with the courage to confront one another in the struggles that are inevitable to intimacy. In this worshiping community, many of us would understand Jesus to be our elder brother, the trailblazer and constant companion for us who are here in time and space. But ultimately, one among many brothers and sisters in an eternally, equally worthy siblinghood. Firstborn, only in the sense that he was the first to show us that it is possible to live in oneness with the divine source while we are here on this planet. I hope none of us would subscribe to the androcentric idolatry that sees Jesus' maleness as central to the incarnation of God's presence in the world. We might be more inclined instead to focus on the pregnant Mary as our image of incarnation. God with us, representing in pregnant Mary all the powerless, the hungry, all the despised women whose bodies God does not overlook, but rather dwells within. In this worshiping community, there might be specialized roles earned by the hard work of those interested in them, but there would be no set hierarchy, just as there was no hierarchy in the early church. I'm referring here to the research of Louise Chautroff, whose remarkable 1993 book has been very influential on this presentation. I quote from Chautroff's Let the Oppressed Go Free. The plea of the sons of Zebedee shows that it is not all that easy to practice equality, even in a small church where the society is built on hierarchic power structures among people. It was not possible to form new concepts and practice different ways at a day's notice. For that reason, the Christians in the New Testament times found a completely radical solution to this problem. They said everybody was to assume the lowest position. In antiquity, the word diakonia identifies the role of those at the bottom of the social hierarchy. That is, the role of slaves or children for women. End of quote. So, in this sense, everybody would be a deacon in the worshiping community I dream of. Could say lots more about depatriarchalizing, but some of it will emerge as I talk about decolonizing and inclusivizing. Aren't those ugly terms but they're useful. The Christian feminist movement and white middle-class feminism in general is currently engaged in learning how to decolonize itself. Just as white men must learn that they do not represent all of humankind, some of them fairly slow studies, some of us white feminists aren't so fast either.
Right.
And we are still in the throes of learning that our agenda is not necessarily the agenda of all women everywhere. As Laura Donaldson puts it, quote, "The family of man has always passed on its patronymy by suppressing the existence of women. But the family of woman cannot afford to pass on its matronymy through the same marginalizing dynamic." In Paradise Lost, one of Milton's characters expresses the ambition others to make, such as I. Well, since the character who desires to make everybody else just like himself is named Satan, we all know that Milton considered colonizing to be devilish work. Yet, as feminist and liberating as many of Milton's concepts are, Milton himself colonized his first wife, and when she died, his second wife, and when she died, his third wife, to make possible his own career without giving up any of the comforts of home and parenthood. Now, my point is, it doesn't matter whether or not we intend to colonize others by using them to further our own agenda, or by assuming we speak for them when in fact we do not. It's the responsibility of those who have been regarded as normative to raise our own consciousness about the harm we have unintentionally been doing to women and men of color, or women and men from the two-thirds world, or lesbians and bisexuals, transgendered people, or children, or elderly people, or poor people, or anyone less powerful than we. And I think we all have some places in us where we are the powerful and some places in us where we are the oppressed. Carter Hayward has written a stunning book, When Boundaries Fail Us, describing the ways patriarchal logic has forced us to raise barriers that kill each other's zest by destroying mutuality. I recommend it to anybody who's concerned about the future of the church. Now, I've sat through various pained discussions among white women in various organizations concerning why our meetings don't attract more racially diverse people. I thought some of the rest of you would have sat in similar discussions. It seems to me that it's colonizing to expect busy people of color to join religious or social action groups in which white people have already set the tone and have already set the agenda. Nevertheless, diversification, for the most part, takes place by adding new voices to already set institutions. Last July, Senator Carol Mosley Braun provided an excellent illustration of the difference it can make when a formerly exclusive organization achieves greater diversity. 4 times during this century, the United States Senate has voted to renew the patent on the insignia of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which is a 7-starred flag that celebrates the states that voted to secede from the Union. And that patent was just about to be renewed for the 5th time, except that Senator Carol Mosley Braun, the first African-American woman ever elected to the Senate, stood up and demanded that legislators reconsider what they were in the process of doing. She said, "This vote is about race." It is about racial symbols, the racial past, and the single most painful episode in American history. After lengthy debate, 27 senators reversed their vote, and the patent was not renewed. In this way, newly diverse voices help to create transformation. In my college classrooms, I'm continually experimenting with ways to hear student perspectives so that they won't merely be colonized to my perspective. So in the Reimagined Worshiping community, we would work hard to recognize the other's subjectivity as equal to our own, as having that same potential and urge toward loving kindness and justice that we sense in ourselves. An important part of that would be showing honor to every world religion, not just to Christianity. So, quote, missionary efforts, unquote, would target only those people who seem to have no sense of the holy, no experience of an incandescent wonder. There would be dialogue and interaction with people from different religious traditions, and there would be mutual modification of the kind that Dr. Chung was discussing, but there would be no more imperialistic attempt